We're the machine learning and digital pathology team. This graphic here kind of just represents a general machine learning pipeline, kind of what a general concepts might look like. I'm Leo, this is Jan, and that's Albert. And we're working with Dr. Bacone. We're specifically focusing on the breast subset of the tissue database we have. So why are we doing this? It's gonna work. So the demand for cancer diagnosis is increasing. As we can see on our x-axis, it shows years from 2022 to 2032, and our y-axis shows market size in billion dollars. And as you can see, we have a pretty large increase. It's working?
Sure.
So as a result of our market size increasing, we're seeing time to treatment is increasing. So each of these colored line represents a different type of cancer. We're going to focus on this red line right here, and that's the breast cancer. So x-axis, we have years from 2004 to 2013, and on y-axis, we have our time to diagnosis. As we can see, even though time's going on, technology is getting better, we're actually seeing an increase in the time to diagnosis. And this is important for an aggressive cancer like breast cancer, where it's important to treat it early so we don't have to do invasive service surgeries like a double mastectomy. Is this my slide?
This is yeah.
Okay. So here's how we gather the data. First, we take a biopsy of breast tissue, which is essentially where we stick a needle in and we get a very small sample of breast tissue. We stain it, and this is just to make it visible because otherwise it would be almost invisible. That's how thin the tissue is. And finally, we scan it using an Imperio scanner. That's at least what Fox Chase does. It's a pretty much an industry standard.
Okay. So let's talk about the data for the different data types. So for a project, we're only working with breast tissue, and all of the data we're given are annotated. Okay, and so for the first image, this is a random breast tissue that's zoomed in, and in the picture, you'll see two green outlines. Those outlines represent regions that are annotated. And the green text right next to them represent labels that classify those regions. So for us, we have nine different types of labels. Four of them fall under non-cancerous, three of them fall under carcinogenic signs, and two of them are cancerous. So what we want our system to do is be able to generate these areas. We wanted to classify areas of malignancy and non-malignancy and also classify them correctly too. So once we have that ready, this is what will happen. So in the hospital, like normally, they would scan biopsy slides and they would send these to us as images. And then the images goes into our system. It will go through a trained model and then it would output a prediction report. The report would have a diagnosis, and the diagnosis contains classification of malignancy and non-malignancy as well as the location of those.
So now that we have a general overview of what our system does, let's get a little bit deeper into what it's required to do. First thing is they need to be able to tell us if a whole slide is cancer or not cancer. This is an industry standard, and we have a couple benchmarks we're going to test it against, but it's not the primary focus of our system. But essentially, this is just saying, is an image cancer? Is it not cancer? We need a functional GUI, and this is so that somebody who's not an expert in our system can still use the product and generate a report. So our GUI needs to show the location of areas and it needs to show the area's probability of malignancy. And finally, this is a self-imposed requirement of a training time of less than 3 days for the models. And this is just because we have a limited time span due to the inherent nature of taking senior design. Otherwise, it would be unreasonable to generate results or anything like that. Our code also needs to be written in Python. And this is because Dr. Bacone's research lab primarily maintains code in Python, and that even if we wrote something that was more geared towards this, it wouldn't be able to be maintained. It would be eventually archived. And we also need something called the Cohen's kappa. And this is essentially where we take the model's predictions and the pathologist's predictions, and we see where their overlap is. And we're shooting for around 60%, which is going to replicate our source here that we've cited. We're trying to aim for at least that much. And finally, we need our F1 score. We're shooting for greater than 90% to this source, but I'm going to go into what F1 score a little bit is, what more it is right about now. So imagine a scenario where you have four apples and a banana, right? And your output is 5 apples from your prediction that your model predicts. Like looking at this as from a human perspective, we can tell that even though it got 80% of the predictions right, it has no idea what a banana is. And so how do we tell our model this? Well, we look at our F1 score. So let's take a look at the apples. We have 4 true positives because it guessed these 4 apples were right and they were over here, they're correct. We had 0 false negatives, so we didn't guess banana for any of these apples. We had 1 false positive because we guessed an apple where a banana was supposed to be. And when we plug this into our equation, we get an F1 score around 89%. And this essentially tells us our model is okay at predicting what an apple is. Now let's take a look at bananas, and it gets a little bit more interesting here. So we have 0 true positives because we didn't guess any bananas right. We have 1 false negative because we guessed an apple where a banana should have been, and we have 0 false positives. And that's just because we didn't even guess bananas at all, so it would be impossible. Finally, plug it into our equation, we get 0%. And this essentially tells us that our model is really bad at predicting bananas. So when we take a look at this, we see, wow, our model's actually not good at differentiating between the two classes. And even though it got 80% right, which isn't a horrible score. So that's what we use F1 score for. So here's our preliminary design of what our model is going to look like. We're going to start with the tissue slides. We're going to do some pre-processing, which is where we prepare them to go into our model, and we will go deeper into that later. We feed them into our model, and then we do some post-processing on the predictions. And finally, we do measurements of accuracy. That's our Cohen's kappa, our F1 score, our whole slide image classification. But first, let me talk about what the slide image is, kind of the path of the data. Not the path, but more the pipeline. So we start off, we have our training data, our development data, and our evaluation data. And why we need 3 different data sets is going to be a little bit more clear in a little bit. But that makes up our whole database, which is 1.2 terabytes or 3,500 images. So we start with our training data, or with all of our data, and we perform the pre-processing on all of them because we want them to kind of be represented uniformly in memory. Then we take our processed training data, and we put that into our model to fit it. And this is kind of the rough cut. But this gives us our trained model. Then we take the development data and we feed that into our trained model. And the reason we do this is because right now our trained model is biased towards our training data. So we take our development data, we process it we feed it into our trained model. We do some post-processing on those predictions to generate something we can score. We score it, and finally get a refined model. And from here on, we don't touch the model, right? So when we feed into our evaluation data, we want to do the pre-processing on the data like we have been. We want to feed that data into our refined model. We want to do that same post-processing, the same scoring, but what we're doing is actually taking our refined model and moving it over to be our production model. So we want to isolate this data set. So if we have any problems with our scoring here, and we're not happy with it, we take it back to the drawing board, and we bounce it between the training and development set. And that's why we have 3 data sets. It's you, Albert, right?
Yeah. Okay, we looked at the overall structure of the pipelines. Let's go into more detail about the preprocessor stage. And everything I'm going to talk about here after this point concerns progress that we made since the last presentation. So since the last presentation, we migrated from one-dimensional to two-dimensional DCT because 2D DCT has certain advantages. DCT is a discrete cosine transform. As a reminder, DCT is a frequency transform that's similar to discrete Fourier transform. This is how we generate features as frequencies in the preprocessor stage. Got 2 images here. On the right, let me explain it a different way. Both of these images were transformed using DCT and recovered using a certain subset of frequencies. Right now we're using all the frequencies, which is 784. The left image is for one-dimensional DCT and the right image is for 2D DCT. But since we're using all the frequencies, we get the same image back. But if we lower the number of frequencies to 40, the image starts to degrade for both cases. Now it's somewhat recognizable. Push that even further at 10 frequencies, it degrades faster for the one-dimensional transform. And the left is pretty much unrecognizable, but even though we're using 10 frequencies, basic form, structure, and shape of the right is generally there. So 2D DCT allows us to use fewer frequencies to describe the same amount of information. Then once DCT generates the features, we use principal component analysis to term features. Yeah. So PCA transforms features into principal components and then uses PCs with the highest variance. It discards all the rest. For both of these methods combined, DCT and PCA, we reduce the number of features by orders of magnitude.
So after pre-processing the data, let's take a deeper look at what at a certain kind of model. There are different models that may work better than others depending on the task that we want to do. And for our case, we want to be able to do really well in image recognition. And something that excels in this is the convolutional neural network, CNN for short. CNNs are very good at learning features by themselves, and they operate by successively convolving input to reach a class label. And this is how the CNN works. So the first layer is the base layer. This is where all the convolution happens and also other operations. There could be multiple convolutions. There's also such things as activation functions that happen here too. And then we take those features and send it to the pooling layer. The pooling layer, all it does is condenses the output into fewer features, and it can either do this by max pooling or average pooling. And then we take those features and put them into the flattening layer. The flattening layer, all it does is string all of the features together into one single long vector. And then the vector gets put into the dense layer. Another name for that is the fully connected layer. So if it doesn't go through this stage, the model might think that all of the data that we computed are probably like just random and not related at all. This dense layer connects all the data together, so that way it can produce a prediction. And then, at the moment, because this is actually a very complicated model, we're not like fully finished the structure. So at the moment, we're using a generic pre-built model to generate results. But after the model, once it gives predictions, then we can move on to the next stage. So we have three types of levels that we have to go through. We have the frame level, patch level, and image level. So right now I'm just going to describe the frame level. This image right here is a random biopsy slide pulled from our data. The X and Y axis are the pixels of the image. So from our parameters, we're given window size and frame size. With the frame size, we segment the image by the frame size, and then we use the window size to have a window. The window has to be bigger than the frame size because we want to include some context from the surrounding frames. So then the window would go through each frame of the image, and as it does that, it would mark a spot where it thinks that it could classify it as some sort of malignancy or non-malignancy type. And then it would keep doing that throughout the whole image. And then eventually, it would look something like this, where an image would have multiple classifications.
Yeah, so the model gives us predictions for each frame, but we need to go from frames to patches. Patches are what we call collections of neighboring frames with the same label. Last slide, we saw that the algorithm splits an image into frames and gives them labels. But sometimes the classifier correctly identifies the border of a malignancy, but it doesn't classify the inside because it doesn't believe it's malignant. Maybe the tumor has white area from fatty or connective tissue or something else like lumen, but this is an example of a slide where green represents malignancy from the classifier's perspective, and it left out the middle part. Whatever the case, we want to fill in that area between the malignant labels, and this is how we do it. Make a copy of the image, then we use flood fill to flood the outside area with malignant labels. The image is then inverted, so malignant becomes non-malignant and vice versa. And on the left here, you see, this is the image that we started out with. On the right is what we just processed. If we superimpose those, then the result is that it's filled in on the inside. And we have the patches, but we also need to classify entire frames. When a pathologist searches through slide images, they should not need to inspect every individual label to understand that a slide contains cancerous tissue. We assign labels to an image based on a hierarchy of labels contained in the image. So this slide on the left receives a normal label. The middle one has something that's potentially carcinogenic. So that's going to take that label. But on the right, we both have cancerous tissue and potentially cancerous. But in that case, we're not concerned about the potentially cancerous. The fact that cancerous tissue already exists means that that slide image will be labeled with cancerous tissue.
Yeah, and so now we're going to talk about our measurements of accuracy. So this is where we talk about our Cohen's cap, which, just to reiterate, it's taking the model predictions and cross-referencing them with the pathologist predictions. We also have our F1 score. I'm not going to re-go through the whole concept, but that still stands. And finally, we need our image classification. This is stuff that we have to work on. We're currently waiting on a couple dependencies from the internal tools that are being worked on. But we're working with a couple people in Dr. Pacone's research cluster to get these done and integrated into the environment. Yeah, any questions?
What happens if like that area is not contained?
It would just, in short, it would just fill it in, which isn't necessarily a bad thing, because we have to deal with oddly shaped tissues that aren't completely filled in.
Sorry, can you explain your question? Area is not contained?
Like if
this one was blank?
Yeah.
Yeah, it would fill it in. But these three here would still be considered cancer. And that's if we have tissue that kind of looks like this instead of like a blob. So it's not a bad thing, but it would just fill it in.
Well, in that case, I mean, we're using a four-way flood fill algorithm. If the bottom part was missing, then that part would not be filled in. So when the flood, well, it does, but it doesn't. When the flood fill runs, everything then receives that label, and then it takes the negative of that, and then it superimposes. So nothing changes. Basically, you just get the image that you started out with. But the reason that we're not filling it in, like we don't want to connect that middle part if the bottom part is missing, because we want to preserve concave shapes. There are concave shapes, like it's not all blobs, and we don't want to just make everything into a normal polygon.
Is this flood fill at the patch level or the frame level?
It's the frame level.
Yeah. This is how we go from frame to patch.
By connecting them, it allows us to use, I don't know if you're familiar with Shapely, but it allows us, it's a Python library, and when it has a solid filled in shape, it allows us to get the border, which is how we go to patch level.
And then does your plans outline where exactly the brain think the cancer is at?
Well, our end goal is just to, we take the borders of these brains. So when we fill this center in here, and we take the border of it, the whole shape will be like this outline right here. I can't reach that high because I'm not that tall, but that'll be the outline.
Okay,
and those will be conorders.
Not like a specific tissue piece. So the frame can have parts that are not cancerous tissue in it?
Yeah, well, the frames, and these are much larger than the frames that we'll actually be using.
Okay.
So it's going to be a little bit less significant in the end product.
Yeah, it's like a trade-off. We can use smaller frames, increase the resolution, but then we increase the computation time. We're going with this frame level classification as opposed to whole slide classification, because we're able to localize where the cancer is, whereas in whole slide, they have to still look for it. But yeah, this is kind of the trade-off of using that method.
Yeah. I just had one curiosity question. So for the three different data sets, let's say your evaluation data isn't comparable to Belgium 1-2, what tells you whether or not to go back to the training data versus the development data?
Yeah.
Just curious.
So in a perfect world, which obviously doesn't exist,
right,
we would have way more than three. We would have enough until, by the time we got to evaluation, it would be good.
Okay.
But the details of why, of like which one we go to,
right.
Like A, I don't fully understand them. They're really complicated loss functions, and there's a lot of math behind it.
Okay.
And it's something that we're going to dive into once we have the scoring done, but we're kind of corresponding with some people in Dr. Pacone's lab to get that finished right now.
Are you asking when do we decide to go from evaluation back to dev?
No, let's say evaluation is not meeting your expectations.
Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned, you know, like you could go back to either one, the training versus the development. I'm just curious, like once you're at the evaluation stage, are you always just going back to development data, or are you ever going back up to the training?
So we can adjust parameters at any point, like any point
right.
of this, right? So if something's off that we think we can correct by retraining our entire model, we'll change a parameter in the model and then we'll retrain it.
Okay.
But if it's just like a small hyperparameter or something that we think we can just like adjust, we'll...
Okay.
This is an oversimplification of it,
yeah.
But we'll go back to a previous version of the model, and then we'll rerun it through dev with it some different parameters.
Yeah, we do the easy part first, which is tuning the hyperparameters, because rebuilding the entire model is more time and effort
intensive.
Okay. Yeah.
Which makes sense why you split it up into three. Okay, I was just curious. So do you actually have like metrics that you use to help you figure out whether you need to go back to the training model or... Or is it more of like a experience kind of?
Well, we don't have anything right now because we're working with a small team of people in Dr. Pacone's lab
okay.
to get this internal tool scored.
We,
and then from there, we might have some metrics.
Yes.
We just have to decide on that.
I was just curious how that.
Yeah, we have very primitive metrics, which is we have base accuracy, which is the mean of the image set. And then we compare that to our model's accuracy. That's just provided by PyTorch. Yeah, and we can compute other things like confidence intervals and stuff like that. So all that is actually used to tune the hyperparameters.
Thank you very much, Dean.
What are they yapping about?
So rude.
I know, but I don't realize, like, you're already perfect. You already have to say both.